Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on a station visit. Concerns grow over the future of the Eurozone. Greece installs an interim cabinet until new elections are held in June. France's new government takes a pay cut as a gesture of shared sacrifice amid the nation's economic troubles. In Syria, fears of Al-Qaeda's increasing presence in that conflict heighten. And the war crimes trial of former Bosnian Serb leader Ratko Mladic is suspended, possibly for months. Joining me in the studio to discuss the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, James Kitfield of National Journal, Nadia Bilbasi of NBC-TV, and Tom Shanker of The New York Times. We want to hear from you, our listeners, during this hour as well. Unfortunately, we are having a network problem with our telephones this morning, which means that if you want to have your voice or comments or questions heard on this show, you're going to need to contact us electronically. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. You can leave a comment on our website, you can leave a comment on Facebook, or you can send us a tweet. We will include listener comments and questions. We just, for the moment at least, these network problems are making it difficult for us to take any phone calls. Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
So, big day today. The Group of Eight, which includes the top seven industrial countries of the Western world plus Russia, are meeting at Camp David. And the meeting comes at a critical time for the future of Europe. We have the 17-member Eurozone is in jeopardy. The Greek voters made it clear they don't like the austerity measures that other members of the Eurozone group were imposing on them. They rejected the government that was obliged to implement those measures. Now they have not been able to, the Greek leaders have not been able to put a new government. So as I said, we have a caretaker government. But the future of Greece's membership in the Eurozone, James Kitfield, at this moment is very much up in the air.
Very much up in the air, and more so because the elections they've called because they couldn't reach a compromise emergency government. The party leading in the polls, the party that rejects outright the bailout package that was agreed upon a couple of months ago. You know, this crisis is the great undead of crises. Every time Europe, you know, sticks a stake in its heart and thinks it's dead, it rises from the dead and comes back and haunts them. And it's rising from the dead because now politics have inserted themselves. You know, the whole European project is built around a lot of elites deciding that this monetary union made a lot of sense. We're going to do this. And you've seen in the past, a lot of times when that's put to referendums, the public has different ideas. Well, now in this austerity-driven response to the crises that has been driven by Germany, has caused 5 years of recession in Greece, that's caused unemployment in Spain to reach depression-era levels, 20% plus. And the publics in these elections are starting to say enough is enough. We can't do this anymore. So there is real concern that Greece, if this new government is elected and it refuses the bailout, could be forced from the Eurozone with absolutely unpredictable circumstances that could directly affect our own presidential election campaign. Because if it's like a Lehman-like event that causes the sort of freeze up of credit around the world and we go into another financial meltdown, it's not going to bode well for President Obama.
Well, Tom Shanker, driven by Germany, a country where you and I both used to live. In fact, this has been the dominant political feature of this whole crisis is the incredible role that Germany has had to play. And yet Angela Merkel faced a pretty hard loss. Her party experienced some losses. So speaking of how politics are driving this crisis, we have German voters really sick of having to bail out the people of the Mediterranean region. And we have the Greek voters, the Italian voters, and the Spanish voters sick of having Germany tell them what to do. do. So we're seeing some real cracks here in the idea of a united Europe.
We certainly are. And Tom, as you mentioned, after Merkel's party suffered that provincial defeat, she actually softened her stance. And there's one more president that you didn't mention who's also caught in a bind here, and that's President Obama, the host of the G8 that James mentioned going on at Camp David. You know, the Obama view of how to pull the U.S. out of its debt crisis was about stimulus, borrowing money, making the economy more vibrant. That's the opposite of what Germany and Merkel have advocated, which is restricting government spending, more austerity to, they hope, instill confidence in the markets. So here's Merkel coming to Camp David, meeting Obama, whose view of how he would have handled it is the exact opposite.
And meanwhile, Nadia, we also have François Hollande there, the new French president, who campaigned also on a anti-austerity platform, although since being elected, he has certainly indicated moderation. And apparently the French stock markets have taken his word that he's not going to move France in a radical new direction.
Well, that is the right. And this is going to be the first time that François Hollande will meet with President Obama. Of course, he wanted to lead by example. So the first thing that the new cabinet did, they said that they're going to slash 30% of their salaries to give the French voters some kind of hope that they're going to change the structure of the economy in a different direction. But let's not forget, this is a socialist government. And for 40 years, France has unable to balance a budget. 40 years, this is like incredible number. And they have this elaborate social benefits. So for him, it's very difficult. So they have to keep it on one side, all these benefits that they had in the past, but also he promised that he's going to reduce the deficit by 2017. Now, his problem probably is he has to be on the good side of Angela Merkel. She's been the driving power in Europe, and he cannot afford to have some kind of friction between the two. And they already coordinated the effort before they came to the G8 and the in telephone phones or telephone calls between UK and Italy as well. And basically what they wanted to do, he wanted to add a phrase into this treaty that they negotiated before, which is to growth. He's saying it's fine about deficit cuts, but we have to stimulate growth. We need to add, as Tom said, stimulus is probably the magic word here, but we wanted to cut the deficit. But what we need to do is we have to ensure that actually the economy is growing, because this is the first sign that we have to look, whether it's in Greece or elsewhere. And I think Greece comes back to the focus now that basically, even if the parties in the end managed to get some government on in June 17th, that growth is going to be a vital issue here.
James Kidfield.
You know, what really scares me about this crisis is that, you know, if you're an observer, as all of us are, of what goes on in Washington, and you've seen this debate about stimulus and Obama between the Republicans preaching austerity caused this town to absolutely be paralyzed. We saw the talks last July that led into a downrating of our credit because they just couldn't reach an agreement. The super committee couldn't reach an agreement. We are paralyzed too. Multiply that by 17 times. That's what the European Union is facing. And the problem there is they're facing two potential death spirals. One of which is just you take on so much debt that your economy is basically all spent on paying and servicing that debt, and you go into a death spiral. Or you take on, you try to introduce stimulus, but that introduces even more debt. So austerity on one side, stimulus on the other, if you're at some level of indebtedness, becomes problematic either way. And, you know, I really worry that this, you talked about structural problems in the European Union. They probably have already been there. They were papered over in good times. I see it's very hard to see an easy way out of this because Germany, as Tom said, is fed up with being the person who's supplying all the money from the borrowing. The bondholders are already making the debt in Spain unsustainable. Spain's too big to bail out. So it's very hard to see. I mean, I imagine they will paper over this initial crisis somehow. But it's hard to see structurally how this has a soft landing.
Well, it seems to me that if you look at the commentaries from Greece, the statements from Greek politicians, the statements from Angela Merkel and others in Europe, they are, in theory, still committed to Greece remaining in the Eurozone. But there's been so much talk over the last many months about Greece leaving the Euro that, you know, budget planners are gaming out the possibilities. And maybe all this talk about Greece staying in the eurozone is just a way, Tom, to buy time while the preparations are actually made for Greece to leave.
That's exactly right. Like so many negotiations, it may go to the 11th hour, but the scenario you laid out, Tom, is very possible that this is a cover story. And if you listen to the voices from the street of Greece, what the population talks about, they just don't see any benefit from the eurozone. If there were a national vote in Greece today, I think it would be overwhelming to leave the euro community. Problem is, that's never happened before. Nobody knows what that does to the global economy.
Tom Shanker is a Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times. Nadia.
I just wanted to disagree here. I think if you hear the statements from Angela Merkel, she said in an interview with the CNBC that I have the will and the determination to keep Greece in the eurozone. I think Germany has been tough in this language, basically to negotiate a bailout, ultimately when the new Greek government take place after June election. The fact that Greece exiting from the eurozone is going to be a complete disaster. If you listen to all the statements coming from European Union, from the head of the European Central Bank, everybody said that it's the interest of Europe to keep Greece there. Now, what's the alternative for them? Is to go back to drachma? We already have $900 million of Greek citizens taking this money out of banks and putting them either abroad or in their homes, the traditional way, under the mattress, basically, because they have no confidence in the system. But ultimately, I think Greece, my prediction, it is that they might stay in the EU.
Of course, James, the big danger of Greece going down that road is that the anxiety will spread to Spain and to Italy. Yeah. And Nadia talked about people taking money out. They start taking money out of Spanish and Italian banks, then we're really in trouble.
And we've already seen it. Spain had to bail out its fourth largest bank this last week. There's a run on banks. The bondholders are getting very nervous about Spanish debt. So we're already seeing what would happen if it goes off the cliff.
James Kitfield is senior correspondent for the National Journal. Nadia Bilbasi also joins us. She's senior U.S. correspondent from the Middle East Broadcast Center, MBC-TV. And Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. He's also the co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. We're going to take a short break in a couple of seconds here. When we come back, we're going to be reading some emails and Facebook messages from you, our listeners. This is the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and this is the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. I'm joined here in the studio by James Kitfield, senior correspondent for the National Journal, and Nadia Bilbasi, senior U.S. correspondent for MBC-TV, and Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. So, James, you mentioned that we are just today, there's going to be a G8 meeting at Camp David, but starting tomorrow is the NATO summit in Chicago. And Tom Shanker, with all the economic problems that the European governments are dealing with, what are the prospects that the United States can expect the kind of help it says it needs from its allies to pay for future operations in Afghanistan? $4 billion dollars a year is the estimated cost of that operation.
If words were dollars, Tom, they'll get everything that they possibly need, but it's the real dollars that they need. I think when President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan lands in Chicago, he's going to make the case that Afghan security forces have improved and are improving, but he'll say flat out, they simply do need the kind of money you talked about, $4 billion a year. Already Britain and France have said they'll give some money, but not the full amount that is needed. So I think it's going to be a great challenge to make this summit anything more than cover for cutting and running.
But it seems that the United States, I think perhaps recognizing all the constraints on secure funding for Afghanistan and the lack of support for it, is sort of redefining the expectations of what should happen in Afghanistan. You wrote about this phrase that what we're looking at in Afghanistan is Afghan good enough. What does that mean?
That's exactly right. Well, early on, of course, the mission was simply to run the Taliban out because they were the host for al-Qaeda and to drive al-Qaeda from the country. But then how interestingly, the Bush administration, a man who ran against the concept of nation building, embarked upon a huge nation building program there, one that was adopted and even expanded by President Obama. I think there's been a deep sense of buyer's remorse, and the goal now is simply to have a country that will never again be a lily pad for launching terrorist strikes against us. But everything else, all the fine words about schools for girls, roads, economic development, governance, that is all. You're not going to hear a bit of that in Chicago.
But Nadia Bilbasi, the important condition for any kind of stability in Afghanistan is the performance of the Afghan security forces, because if the United States and its allies pull out of Afghanistan, it's all going to be on the shoulders of those Afghan security forces. And what can you tell us about their capability right now?
Absolutely. And I think this just reminds the listeners that the United States is very keen on keeping this date, the 2014th. They wanted to make sure that Afghanistan is functioning enough. And they don't want to repeat the mistake of what the Soviets did, that basically they cut the help and this money that they wanted. So civil war will ensue after. Now, the security forces is... It depends on who you're talking to. I mean, American generals, they said they're doing fine. And basically, by giving another 18 months, they're supposed to give two-thirds, I think, of responsibilities to the Afghan forces. But just look at the last 2 weeks. There is attacks, attempted assassination of the governor in Farah province, which is relatively quiet. We have seen another attack, assassination on the governor of Kandahar. So the Taliban is coming back in what they call the spring offensive. They basically wanted to show that they're still in charge. They able to cause serious problem. And also they managed to assassinate probably a topic we'll talk about later in details about this peace negotiator, Ursula Rahmani, who was gunned down in a traffic jam in Kabul to show that they are still able. Their abilities also is to penetrate the security forces. If you look at most of the attacks against the Americans and NATO forces, it's basically Taliban disguising themselves, Taliban fighters disguising themselves as the security forces. So they dress up like them, they go to the compound, there was chaotic situation, they don't know what's going on, and they managed to succeed with their attack. So well, they still, I think this is questionable, their ability to take over.
And the assassination of that peace negotiator is very bad news, because in almost any scenario for withdrawing from Afghanistan, there's got to be some negotiations, right, James?
There does, and the negotiations have been stalled since they killed his predecessor last fall,
Rabbani.
Basically, these negotiations have gone nowhere. First, President Karzai felt like he was insufficiently consulted on them. The Taliban was trying to get some release of prisoners from Guantanamo. The whole thing's basically fallen apart now. Hard to see how we are going to pressure the Taliban back to the table now when you see this, all the optics look like kind of a rush for the exit. You talked about the French socialist new president, Hollande, has said that he wants to accelerate France's withdrawal following the Canadians and the Dutch. And everyone's, so it's, this thing is hanging by a thread, basically, and the Obama administration's goal at NATO summit will be to sort of provide a unified front that we're sticking it out till 2014, end of, and we will support the Afghan security forces after that with, as Tom said, $4 billion, which we'll probably end up paying $3 billion of, at least. And it's going to be a dicey thing whether this house of cards stays up. Having said that, I actually think that the Afghan security forces have been a sort of silver lining here. I've spent some time with them they are, when they are taking the lead, showing a fair amount of capability. We have to remember the Taliban, even though it launches these attacks on the governor's provincial mansion, was repelled. All the killers, you know, that is not a strategic threat. Strategic threat is that the Kabul government is not able to sort of hold the thing together with those security forces. I actually think there is still a possibility that can happen, but not if, you know, everyone starts rushing for the exits.
Tom Shanker.
But if you look at 11 years of war, $1 trillion in American money, several thousand lives, all the thousands more who've been wounded. And the best guess for what post-2014 looks like is a re-Talibanization of the South. It'll be a softer, gentler Taliban, but their influence will return. Heavy Iranian influence in the West. In the East, you have Pakistani influence and the Haqqani, a criminal network, running things. And the president of Afghanistan is basically the president of Kabul County, Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Is that what victory looks like?
Well, you said Afghan good enough. You weren't the first to say that, but no, I think that if the Taliban take over, you know, they definitely have reinfiltrated somewhat in Kandahar and Helmand, their traditional strongholds. If they take the southern part of the country and the country starts to fracture like that, you will probably see a civil war, and that will be an absolute failure. I don't think that's inevitable. Is what I'm saying.
Not yet. These reports from Afghanistan certainly have to weigh on Francois Hollande. And as James says, he has pledged to withdraw French troops from Afghanistan, but he is meeting today at the White House with President Obama. Then he'll be at Camp David as part of the G8. Then he's going to be at the NATO summit. How much pressure is Francois Hollande going to be under to reconsider his pledge to pull everybody, all the French troops, out of Afghanistan?
Actually, Tom, there is close advisors to the president who said that it's very unlikely that he will come to Chicago to attend the NATO summit.
Oh, really?
And he will come without saying that, first of all, donating the money that they wanted. I think the Americans put the shopping list of $200 million. Mm-hmm. He will come, and it will be very hard for him not to deliver something. That something could be part of the money that the administration wanted from them, and also probably not withdrawing the troops. But he's under huge pressure. Let's remember that this is the president candidate who basically ran on a platform of anti-war. Second, there is a huge fatigue in Europe towards Afghanistan, as Tom said, after 11 years of war. People are tired of it. And I think there is a division between the United States and Britain on one side and the rest of Europe on the other side, because the rest of Europe look at Afghanistan and say, look, we have a corrupted government, we have abuse of human rights, and all what we need now is to cough up this money, which is a ridiculous amount. I mean, two-thirds of it is going to come from the United States, but still, they wanted $125 million from Canada, $20 million from Finland, tiny small country, $40 million from Sweden. Imagine. So these countries saying, maybe we don't want to do that. But ultimately, they know that not just because of the lack of interest in the security situation or instability, because once Afghanistan descend into civil war, we have the regional powers. We're going to see Iran and India and Pakistan and all these people meddling inside Afghanistan. So it's their interest to do something. But I think Francois Hollande will be under pressure to do something. Maybe he will stick to the date of withdrawing 2013.
We'll see.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, James.
I was just going to say, you know, I would like to put the money in perspective, though. We alone spend about $90 billion a year right now at current force levels in Afghanistan. If we can pull out in 2014, transition to Afghan security forces that cost $4 billion a year, it can start to look like a pretty good bargain.
And we've all seen this movie before. It's actually called Charlie Wilson's War, where after the United States supported the proxy forces, we forgot about the place and what was born, Al-Qaeda.
Well, Tom Shanker, what is going to happen at this NATO summit? Can we expect anything, any news, any suspense at this NATO summit in Chicago, or is it totally preordained?
If there's some major news development to come out of Chicago, Tom, the administration has kept it as secret as the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Basically, it's coming together, holding hands, kumbaya, and a pledge of long-term support through 2014 and for a decade afterwards. But we've been given no indication of major news.
I want to read an email that we got this morning from Carla. And by the way, to our listeners, please send us your emails. We're going to be reading them. We're going to be reading Facebook messages and Twitter messages all morning. This is an email from Carla, who says a number of countries, including Turkey, are trying to add the issue of Macedonia's membership again to the NATO agenda. Despite the ruling by the International Court of Justice, Greece seems determined to block the effort. No surprise there. I'd like to hear the panelists' comments on this, and especially on the U.S. position. Nadia, are you have you been following the Macedonia issue? The Macedonia issue is an issue that, like a few others, really divides Greece and Turkey.
Yeah, just like Cyprus and and other conflicts that haven't been solved. But I haven't actually been following it in details. But, you know, the membership in the EU is always an interesting point for countries to vie for
NATO,
power.
For
NATO in particular. So, of course, Turkey is a prominent power there, and they play a role very much in Afghanistan, but also in Syria, that if another conflict that... it's now occupying so many attention in the corridor of power of what's going to be happening there. But I think sometimes that this little countries that they wanted to have some membership then in the EU or NATO, whatever they wanted to do, they basically, they're bargaining chip. They will use something against something. But I'm not actually familiar with the details when it comes to Macedonia.
Well, it'll be interesting to hear what Turkey has to say at this NATO summit, won't it, James? Because Turkey is a country very much on the front line of perhaps not Afghanistan, but a number of other conflicts, including Syria.
It will be interesting. I mean, Turkey is a strategic linchpin primarily right now with Syria. And I personally think Macedonia is way down on the priority of the agenda. So I don't see any movement on that. And we've seen with Cyprus that if one, you know, NATO acts as, you know, on the principle of unanimity, which means that if Greece doesn't want it in, it won't get in. It's as simple as that. But again, I don't think they're going to spend a lot of time. You know, NATO is at a really perilous moment. You're going to hear a lot of really flowery rhetoric and communique in these communiques from Chicago about how, you know, we're all standing together in lockstep. But the fact is, Europeans are slashing their defense budgets. They've come up with this sort of window dressing of smart defense to sort of rationalize doing more with less. The U.S. has announced is pulling troops out of Europe, announced a pivot to Asia. This made the new Eastern European members of NATO very nervous because they still are in the shadow of Russia. You have the whole problem surrounding Afghanistan. So despite all the flowery rhetoric, this is a very perilous moment for NATO, I think. And, you know, the best thing you can say about the alliance, though, is it has persisted through really tough times before, and I expect it will persist again because, as a lot of experts say, there is no alternative to NATO.
James Kitfield is senior correspondent for the National Journal. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tom Shanker, I interrupted you. Just
not
you
at all. James' description of NATO reminds me it's really a dysfunctional marriage, but all the countries stay together for the kids.
Well, you know, NATO's last engagement was in Libya. And that showed a couple of things. One, it showed, as James said, that, you know, NATO still has a role to play. I mean, you know, in theory, at least, the NATO role in Libya was important. It also showed, of course, how much NATO allies depend on the United States. But now we have a much tougher test case coming up for NATO, and that is, as James mentioned, Syria.
Exactly right. And just to underscore your point, yes, the Libya campaign was NATO-led, but, you know, we can get the statistics. 80% of the ordnance, 80% of the strike sorties, you know, were run by the Americans. And it's just, you know, that can't be forgotten. Syria, though, you know, there was a op-ed this morning by a leading senator calling for greater involvement. The comparison, though, is impossible. Syria has a much stronger military, much more integrated military. The president seems to be in a much stronger state, and the opposition is not at all united. So while the 10,000 civilian deaths is a travesty and a shame, it's very difficult, Tom, to see an easy military answer as was offered in the Libya situation.
Nadia Bilbasi, the news in the last few weeks has been the United Nations mission in Syria, but I think everyone agrees it is not going well. We just had news this morning of government troops attacking demonstrators in Aleppo, and there were actually UN observers on the scene, and they were not able to do anything.
No, because they are a monitoring force. They're not authorized to do anything else, just like we see them all over the place. And in fact, it reminds me of other conflicts, like in Rwanda, for example. You know, when you make the UN forces a target themselves, although the UN till now, they could not verify if they were targeted or they caught in crossfire. But basically, this UN monitoring forces were in a place called Khan Sheikhoun, and they came under attack, and they were held for a few hours, and finally, they were allowed to leave. And this town town was held by what they called the Syrian Free Army. Now, the situation there, everybody knows that this monitoring team and Annan plan is failing, but nobody yet willing to accept that it has failed. The only thing they're doing is basically not monitoring the peace, because there is no peace, but causing some kind of lull in the fighting. So the demonstrators take refuge when they see the UN forces there. They allow them to go out. And actually, despite that, this particular incident, the security forces fired on a funeral procession, and they killed 20 people there. But the situation in Syria, it is it's really a sad one, because it seems that President Assad still have a grip on power, that the international community have no will to move beyond what we have now, which is let's send this, first of all, the Arab League monitors, let's send the UN monitors, let's send the Annan teams, etc. Because still now what they're doing, the Americans, is basically outsourcing the conflict or managing the conflict to the Saudis and to the Turks and other countries by giving this assistance to the opposition, what's called non-lethal, but even arming them without being involved directly.
Well, you say non-lethal, but you also mentioned Saudi Arabia, but the Gulf countries are actually more and more inclined, it seems, James, to actually send some weapons to the rebels and to intervene more actively. There's been a lot of stuff going in to boost the rebels.
Right? More than inclined, they are doing it. They're arming the rebels, and what the news is the last week or two is that we are actually coordinating that effort. We're actually helping them with communications. I mean, we are slipping into a involvement here, and here's why. You know, I totally agree with Tom. I've always gotten queasy about Syria. But the things that make you nervous about Syria, that it could fracture, that a civil war breaks out, that the Sunni-Shia divide gets, you know, superheated in ways that might spread to the region. If this civil war continues as it is, all those things are happening anyway. And at some tipping point, and we've seen it with Senator Lieberman and with Libya and Senator McCain, at some tipping point, the cost of inaction actually becomes almost greater than the cost of action. And then I can see it's getting drawn in.
James Kitfield, senior correspondent for the National Journal. This is the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. I'm Tom Gelton. Stay listening. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by REI, with gear and advice for a lifetime of outdoor adventure and stewardship since 1938, in stores and at REI.com. By Constant Contact, working to help small businesses turn fans into customers with social campaigns. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Office Depot, offering forever postage stamps like at the post office. Office Depot has postage stamps. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with Donna Summer. She's died of cancer at the age of 63. One of the best singers of the disco era, her hits included Bad Girls, Last Dance, Hot Stuff, and On the Radio. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm, and this is the international hour of the Friday News Roundup. My guests in the studio are James Kitfield, senior correspondent for the National Journal, also Nadia Bilbasi, who's senior U.S. correspondent for NBC-TV, and Tom Shanker. He's the Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. He's also co-author of the acclaimed new book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. We want to include you, our listeners, in our conversations this morning. You can certainly send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. You can send us messages on Facebook or Twitter. And we do have a special phone number for you to call this morning. This is a number for today only. We've had a little bit of a network problem with our regular phone number, but this phone number will work. Take it down. It's 202-244-4176. This is a number for reaching us today only, 202-244-4176. And so we will be going to your calls when you are able to get through to us. Let's stay with the Syria for a minute. You know, we've talked about the James Kitfield mentioned the danger of a sectarian conflict there. We're talking about the increasing evidence of the rebels being armed in Syria. But a very troubling development this week, Tom Shanker, two big car bombs in Damascus that left 60, 70 people killed. And Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, yesterday came out and said it looks to him like this was the work of Al-Qaeda.
That's exactly right, Tom. You'll remember that one of the Al-Qaeda rat lines into Iraq, where Al-Qaeda Mesopotamia was so successful at, you know, killing American troops and almost pushing the country to a civil war, that rat line went from Damascus into Anbar. Well, it looks like that rat line is now being reversed, and Al-Qaeda is indeed coming in to Syria. Now, we've spoken to a lot of senior intelligence officials. They're not seeing them in particularly large numbers, but as you said, these car bomb attacks are signature Al-Qaeda, and this could be the start of what could be a very devastating terror campaign.
And if Al-Qaeda were involved, it would, on the one hand, underscore the sectarian issues, because Al-Qaeda is, of course, a very sectarian Sunni group, but it would also make outsiders all the more nervous about becoming involved. Right, Nadia?
Oh, absolutely. But nobody wants Al-Qaeda anywhere now. I mean, you know, they're very unpopular in the last days in their operation in Iraq. Actually, people wanted them out. So I don't think they will gain in any support, but they definitely add to the dimension of that this regime is seen as an Alawite, which is offshoot of Shiite Islam, and now you have the majority of the people, which is led by the Muslim Brotherhood inside Syria, who are Sunnis. And we've seen actually part of this conflict is spilling into Lebanon. We have seen the last few days has been a sectarian attack in the city of Tripoli in the north. Few people are dead. And this is quite serious as well, if we, you know, seen the implication of that. But I think Ban Ki-moon statement has caused some, raised some eyebrows, because he has no evidence to show that. And people were worried, where did he get this information? Although everybody kind of assume that Al-Qaeda is operating there. And but we have no real hard evidence to show that actually they're behind all this attack, although they bear the modus operandi of all these car bombs.
Well, I think that's what he was saying. It bore the hallmarks of Al-Qaeda. I don't have the exact words in front of me. He didn't say he had evidence that it was Al-Qaeda, but
right.
It certainly had that. Now, you mentioned increased fighting in the north. I want to put this question to you, James Kitfield. This is from Matt in Plano, Texas. What would NATO do if Turkey and Syria were to start fighting?
Well, Turkey is a NATO country,
exactly.
So I mean,
attack on all.
Exactly, and if Turkey decided that this threat had become such that they had to act, I think that NATO would probably have to be behind them, and I think that that would again would spell how you would see a NATO in a Western operation. First thing they'd probably do would create safe havens in northern Syria that were guarded by NATO air power, and they had some Turkish probably troops on the ground that would be a buffer zone, because Turkey has all these refugees coming across that border. But at that point, you would see a very massive escalation of the arming of the opposition, trying to organize them, trying to separate them from the Al-Qaeda elements that exist. I mean, the Al-Qaeda analogy is interesting because like I said, you know, no one wants to get involved in Syria except unless Syria, all the things that you don't want to happen in Syria start happening anyway. If al-Qaeda starts to get a foothold in Syria and it loves these conflict zones, then that would be, I think, an argument that Turkey and others would use. You don't want to give al-Qaeda another foothold in our region. We've got to act. So I think that it's a, you know, I'm not saying it's a probability, but certainly I see it as a possibility.
I want to go back to some emails that we have gotten. This one is from SR. It's about Afghanistan. I'm concerned about, and we've been talking about this, about Afghan soldiers increasingly killing U.S. and NATO soldiers. That would lead to a trust deficit among the Afghan and U.S. forces. I'm skeptical that U.S. and NATO will succeed in Afghanistan. How is it that the world's most sophisticated, well-armed military has been unable to defeat a ragtag army of the Taliban and Haqqani insurgencies even after 11 years? Boy, that is the question, isn't it, Tom Shanker?
That's a terrific question, and the person sent the email has hit all the right tones. The deficit of trust is very worrying. It's interesting, most of these incidents where Afghan soldiers have killed Americans, it's called Green on Blue, have not been Taliban infiltration. And in an odd way, it would almost be more satisfying if it was, because then the enemy had come into your camp and slit your throat. But it's the soldiers with whom American troops have been working shoulder to shoulder. And so these killings are because of personal animosities and a frustration. And to the second part of the question, counterinsurgencies always take decades to end, and they only end, as we discussed earlier, with reconciliation and peace talks.
And peace talks don't look too good right now, do they, Nadia?
Doesn't look at good at all, actually, because we just mentioned that the peace negotiator was killed. The previous one as well was killed. So it leaves Afghanistan and President Karzai in a tight spot.
Nadia, Donald writes, can the Taliban be held back as long as they reap vast sums from the opium business? This seems to be a topic rarely discussed, he says.
That's true. I mean, this is the elephant in the room. I mean, we kind of talk always about Afghanistan in terms of the military power and in terms of insurgencies and holding towns and clearing them, but actually this is the trade that basically makes millions of dollars, and it affects the region and the world when it comes to the money. And they've been very successful in that. And we have seen rebel groups, insurgents has been cultivating, whether it's the drugs or money laundering or all kind of things with Hezbollah. We've seen it. We've seen it with the Taliban. We've seen it with many militias who basically use this as cash money for them. And it's very difficult to control.
James Kitfield, I have a math question for you from Eric from Alexandria, Virginia.
I don't do math questions.
And you're not allowed to use your calculator. $4 billion a year. How much is that on a per capita basis for the Afghan people?
Oh, that's hard to say. 28 million Afghans. So you divide that, and I need my calculator. But you know, it's.
Again, I'm not sure if he thinks this is a lot or a little.
Well, I mean, you know, $4 billion is $4 billion, but let's put it in perspective. Yeah. We give each year to Israel $3 billion plus. We give each year to Egypt $2 billion plus. So right there, the top two recipients, you're talking about one more heavy recipient. You know, how important is us that Afghanistan doesn't fall back into that cycle of civil war that led it to be rife territory for al-Qaeda and the Taliban? And that's, you know, what dollar tag do you want to put on that?
Okay, I want to move to a whole different part of the world, a part of the world that doesn't get much attention anymore. Unfortunately, it's a part of the world where I have spent some time, and that is Central America. Tom Shanker, rather than go to Afghanistan or Iraq, you went to a very different place to see U.S. military, but U.S. drug enforcement operations in Honduras. Tell us about your trip there, what those armed drug enforcement agents are doing.
Right, you're exactly right, Tom. And the reason I went there was for the exact reason that you said. After 10 years focusing on the Middle East and Southwest Asia, I was trying to find out what the military and our government's doing elsewhere and quietly. And I spent a week in Honduras where the American military is taking a page from the counterinsurgency strategy and bringing it to the drug war. The military has built three forward operating bases in Honduras. They're sort of lily pads for counter-drug operations. In the past, the DEA and the Honduran police had to launch their drug raids from the capital Tegucigalpa whenever they got a radar track of a drug plane coming in. It's 3 hours, bad weather, mountains. So the military built three bases right in the middle of the rainforest where these drug planes land. Now, the military is very wary of getting drawn back into the dirty wars of the 1980s. So after building these forward operating bases, they turned them over to the Honduran police and the DEA. Two missions have been carried out with this new system. They've gotten, you know, several thousand pounds of cocaine. But in the most recent one, last Friday, in a 2 a.m. crossfire, four people were killed, including two pregnant women. So the people of this area are outraged. The U.S. government and the Hondurans say this entire village was part of the trafficking network. The mayor and the local governor say no, these are innocent fishermen.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom, you say that this is a carryover from counterinsurgency operations or lessons that we've learned from doing counterinsurgency operations in other countries. One of the features of counterinsurgency operations has been civilian casualties.
That's exactly right. So you bring the techniques, you bring the chance for success, and you bring all of the risks just as well. But I would just tell your listeners, Central America and the drug war is going to be the next major effort of this government.
You know, and one of the things I'm curious about, Tom, is whether the fact that there is a new government, we had this coup in Honduras in 2009, and the new government has been much more pro-U.S. than the old government. Is that the explanation for this collaboration?
That is part of it, of course, but also Honduras has one of the highest homicide rates in the world per capita. It is a country that's literally falling apart from the inside. I think the government's trying to get any help it can.
I want to go now to a listener. Jacqueline is calling us from Melrose, Massachusetts. We do have a phone number for you to reach us on. It's 202-244-4176. Jacqueline reached us on that number. Good morning, Jacqueline. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Very fascinating show. If we, after we lost almost 3,000 people on that terrible day in 9/11, if we have gone to war and killed in Afghanistan something around 40 to 50,000 Afghans, and in Iraq, a war that was admitted by the president, former President Bush, as a mistake because there were no WMDs there, something like a half million, if not a million, Afghans have been killed. All the deaths of so many Afghans, much more than we lost on 9/11. Aren't we afraid of, and aren't we causing more terrorist possibilities against us?
What do you think about that, Nadia? Do we need to worry about retaliation for all the damage that has been inflicted on Afghanistan?
Well, you know, we have to put it in perspective. After 9/11, I think it was no option for the U.S. government but trying to strike out against al-Qaeda bases there and to get it out of Afghanistan. They wanted it to be done in some kind of a deal with the Taliban, who refused to hand over Osama bin Laden. I agree with the listener totally that the Iraq war was a war of choice. It was not a war of necessity. And now we're looking at the consequences of that with the Arab Spring. Actually, Iraq, probably, if you look at it, probably will be the least democratic, because in terms of who's taking power, who's consolidating power in the hands of the prime minister, in terms of the religious party taking over, etc. So maybe even the mission ultimately of bringing democracy into that part of the world did not succeed. But in retrospect, if you look now and you look at the new strategy that probably this Obama administration is using in particular, they actually using a new thing, which is striking what we have seen in Yemen, which is basically using targeting counter-terrorism, targeting al-Qaeda and other jihadist group by using this drone attacks in Pakistan and Yemen. And it seems to be more effective than sending an army and invading countries and have boots on the ground and having thousands of people are dead and trillions of dollars are wasted. So now I think we're going to look into a new way of dealing with conflict and rising terrorism.
Of course, there have been a few innocent people killed in drone attacks as well. Nadia True. Bilbasi is senior U.S. correspondent for NBC TV. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And we can't let this hour pass without touching on a story that matters to those of us, including Tom Shanker and myself, who covered the war in Bosnia, one of the most brutal military commanders the world has seen in a long time. General Ratko Mladic is on trial in The Hague. James Kitfield, I don't know if you've been following this.
Sure.
A very brief couple days, you know, he did confront his some of the survivors, some of the accusers, but then the trial was almost immediately suspended. Tell us what's going on here.
Well, it's unfortunate because, you know, it's justice. The wheels of justice turn very slow in The Hague. We've learned that, and it's unfortunate. It's a very bureaucratic system, and it takes years to bring these guys. As we'll remember, Milosevic, who was probably the chief war criminal from that war, you know,
former
died
president of Serbia. Mm-hmm.
Right, died died in custody while he was waiting, while he was going through his long, drawn-out trial. In this case, it's like the prosecutors botched, did not give exculpatory evidence to the defendant's lawyers. So they've suspended the trial. They're asking for 6 more months. So it's unfortunate. But, I know you do and Tom does. Anyone who's reported from there takes some measure of satisfaction of seeing this guy have to confront his accusers, because he is the butcher of Srebrenica, where they rounded up, roughly 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys and executed them. I've sat over those grave sites as they pulled those people out of them. One of the most, probably the most horrific, genocide in Europe since World War II. So to see him in the dock is a certain amount of satisfaction to me.
Although Tom Shanker, he did confront some of his accusers, including survivors of the Srebrenica massacre. No evidence whatsoever that he feels any remorse for what happened.
Even more than that, Tom, as you know, he looked at one woman and made a slash mark across his throat, as if I had the knife, I'd do the same to you right now. So here is a man who is completely without remorse. He's certainly not the swaggering general Mladic that you and I used to see at Zvornik and at Pale back in the years that we were covering it. He is in the dock, but I don't think he is reformed or shows any remorse whatsoever.
Nadia.
And also, if you look at Bosnia 20 years after the war, it's still very much a divided city. And actually, what was disturbing, that when Mladic was led to the courtroom, some of the Serbs, including young ones who were not alive at the time when the war took place, they were clapping and cheering because they saw him as a hero who was defending Serbian rights.
Nadia Bilbasi is senior U.S. correspondent for NBC Television. The Middle East Broadcast Center have also been joined this morning by James Kitfield, senior correspondent for National Journal, and Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times and co-author of Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. I've received a number of emails this morning, and before we go out, I just want to sort of quickly go through a couple of them. A comment from a Finnish point of view about the Greek crisis. I wish the Americans would not paint the Germans and other creditor countries as ruthless penny pinchers. Austerity means structural reforms. All that the Germans and Finns want is that the Greeks start to reform their economy with measures that are truly no-brainers for any normal Western country. There are a lot of emails about the situation in Greece. This is an undisclosed person who wrote, every crisis can produce solutions, and the Greek financial problem is no exception. Greece is the home of democracy, and it is a desired tourist destination. So I think this reader, this listener wants us to maintain some measure of optimism about the future of Europe. This has been the International Hour, the Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. I'm Tom Gelton. Thanks for listening.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.